Thanks for joining us for our special series, Democracy Optimists, with Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law. Democracy Optimist is produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU.
What does it mean? To be American?
Throughout the 2024 election season, we're bringing you conversations with election and voting experts from all across the political spectrum, so that when you arrive at your polling place on November 5th, you'll know how it all works, and you'll be ready to cast your ballot. Here's Josh Douglas.
You've heard about Zuckerbucks, right? Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan donated almost $400 million to local election officials to help run the 2020 election during the pandemic. Some conservative lawmakers made a big stink, thinking that the funds were used only in liberal-leaning places, which was demonstrably false. How do I know? Because one of the smartest and most ethical people in the world of election administration helped to administer some of those funds, and we are so lucky to have him join our show. David Becker is the executive director and founder of the nonpartisan nonprofit Center for Election Innovation and Research. David, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks, Josh. That's very high praise coming from you. I really appreciate that.
Well, it's true. You've been touching so many of these issues that are so important to just the nuts and bolts of how elections run. And that's a lot about what this show is about, is explaining to voters how do elections actually work. So let's dive in. Your organization, the Center for Election Innovation and Research, helped to administer at least 60 million of these so-called Zuckerbucks to election offices. Tell us how that happened and how it all worked.
Yeah, it was closer to 65 million, actually. And what happened was, I'd been working with election officials. That's what I do on a day-to-day basis, election officials all across the country, from secretaries of state all the way down to county and local election officials, Republicans, Democrats, from, you know, Alaska to Florida. And as COVID hit, everyone was scrambling. Their offices were already under-resourced, and we were getting ready for what we expected would be the highest turnout election in American history, and it turned out to be. So that means there's a lot of voters participating who are already not very familiar with how to navigate the system, and then you throw the pandemic in there. And what I was hearing from election officials all over the country was that, you know, as they were offering other options, early voting and mail voting to voters, as they were having to move voting sites to larger areas, even like sports arenas, to allow for social distancing, as they needed to recruit more poll workers because older poll workers were at risk during COVID, they were really having trouble making ends meet and providing voters with the information they needed to navigate, regardless of whether they were Republican or Democratic voters or anything else. And out of the blue, I got a call from a representative for Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg at the end of August, asking me, if you had a lot of money, what would you do with it right now? And I first of all, I should say, when they said a lot of money, I thought they were talking about maybe a couple of $100,000. And I said I would try to get it to the states, so for purely for nonpartisan voter education, just to help voters understand what their options were, whatever those options were in the states, and they were different in many states, how they could remain safe and still make their voice be heard, how they could recruit more poll workers and volunteer if they wanted to. And within just a couple of days, they said, this is great. We're going to give you money. They knew I had connections to all of the states. I'd been working extensively with people across the political spectrum. And one of the things I'm most proud of now, I mean, it still seems crazy at the time, but we, from the moment I got that call till the moment we got the first money out the door, was about 30 days. I still can't believe we got it out that fast. It was really thanks to them as well. They were incredibly generous. And we made a commitment. I contacted every single state, told them about the availability of these grants. 24 states applied for them across the political spectrum. One withdrew, that was Louisiana, but the other 23 states all got exactly the amount of money they requested. We exercised no discretion. We didn't weed out any states. And they included states that were blue and included states that were redder, states like Ohio and Missouri and Florida and others.
And let's just make this point clear. The states didn't have enough money to run a successful election during the pandemic, or at least it would have been a lot harder. And there were no strings attached for what this money could be used for as long as it was for the election administration. And there was no partisanship involved in giving any of this out.
That's exactly right. There was one big string attached, which is that it could not be partisan. It had to be nonpartisan. If they were going to contact any voters, they had to contact all voters. They had to give them the same information so that voters knew how to navigate the process. That was absolutely essential. And we were also very committed to transparency. As soon as we had finalized accounting for this, which occurred early in 2021, shortly after the election was over, we published a report on our website. It's been up there since March 2021. That lays out all of the states that applied, exactly how much money they got and what they spent it on.
So what do you make of the fact that over half the states in the country now have banned private donations for election administration? You get these, you know, Zuckerbucks. They're not called Beckerbucks, I guess. The Zuckerbucks money that states have now, you know, banned. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we should first recognize that, you know, philanthropy coming to the rescue in 2020 was never plan A. I mean, plan A should be the government fully funds its democracy, fully funds and gives resources to its election officials from the state level all the way down to the county and municipal level. But that just doesn't happen. And that's a real crisis when we have something like the pandemic comes along that really affects all voters and how we run elections in many ways. And many voters were worried about voting in person, how they can navigate that given that context. So it would be far better if government from Congress and especially at the state legislative level, more fully funded election officials to do their job properly. But in the absence of that, philanthropy stepped up and did us a favor. And I think we should be thanking them. And rather than banning these funds. But if states really thought that private funding from philanthropy shouldn't be involved in this, I think that what they should do is tie that to more fully funding election officials through public funding, through their own purse strings. And we haven't seen that. We've seen what they're really doing is restricting a potential source of resources for election offices to run elections better, while not, on the other hand, providing them adequate resources to compensate.
All based on a myth that there's something, you know, going on with these funds and not based on any facts whatsoever.
Yeah, as with so many myths, as so many outright lies about the 2020 election, this is based just solely upon the fact that some people didn't like the outcome. I mean, I understand that. We've all voted in elections where our candidate didn't win. That's something that's a very American thing. That's what elections are all about. But the difference here is that whether it's Zuckerbucks or ballot harvesting or, you know, Italian servers and German satellites and bamboo ballots and dead Venezuelan dictators, it's all an effort to rationalize the anger over an election loss rather than anything actually based on fact.
You're giving me some bad flashbacks to the end of 2020 and early 2021, where it was like playing whack-a-mole of beating back one conspiracy theory after another that a lot of us in the election space were trying to do in whatever way we could. Let's talk about voting machines, another area that is rife of falsehoods and myths and lies. Are voting machines actually secure?
So any kind of technology has potential vulnerabilities. The computers we're using right now to talk to each other, the phones we use all the time, and voting machines aren't immune to that. There's no technology in the world that's completely secure. The question is whether you've protected it adequately and you've got mitigation so that you can make sure that if something goes wrong, it doesn't affect the outcome. And in that way, we're doing better than we ever have. The key to secure voting technology are paper ballots under current technology, or paper ballots and audits of that technology by checking the paper ballots against the voting machine. So in 2020, 95% of all voters in the United States voted on paper ballots. That includes all the voters in all of the battleground states. There are only a handful of states that still have some form of digital balloting, states like Louisiana and Mississippi. But all of the battleground states had paper, really for the first time in about 100 years. states like Georgia and South Carolina had no paper ballots in 2016, as recently as 2016. And most of North Carolina, Virginia, and Pennsylvania had no paper ballots, or had digital ballots rather than paper ballots in 2016. Whereas all of those states were all paper. We remember the hand recount of all the presidential ballots in Georgia in 2020, which would not have been possible 4 years earlier when Donald Trump won that state, and won that state legitimately, I should say. We have no evidence to the contrary. So we have all of those paper ballots, and we have more audits of those ballots than ever before. 43 states plus DC ran audits in 2020. I should say there's going to be more paper ballots and more audits in 2024, which is fantastic. Those audits basically mean you take a sampling of the paper ballots, you count them by hand, and then you compare them to the machine tally. And if they match, you know you've done okay. And if they don't match, you keep looking at the paper ballots to see if there's a problem. Fortunately, we've never found one like that. So voters should be absolutely confident in the systems we have in place. Not that the machines operate perfectly, because no machine does, but we have a check against any kind of machine malfunction or potential malware event, where we can be confident that the ultimate certified count is going to be accurate.
So this gets a little nuanced, though, because the best practice is paper ballots, as you said, and yet machines to count the ballots, at least in the first instance. And you hear a lot of these arguments from certain people who seem less informed that, well, you know, we have paper ballots, we have to hand count, and we only trust hand counting of ballots. And what you're saying, and election experts generally say, is that best practice is paper ballots with machine counts. So walk us through that seeming dichotomy.
Yeah. So counting. So first of all, we should note that our ballots in the United States are extremely complex. Anyone who votes knows this. They have to, sometimes you have to think about this because it's different than almost everywhere else in the world. Almost everybody in the United States has multi-page ballots with dozens of races on them. So you're not just counting one thing. Imagine a huge jar full of jelly beans that human beings would have to count. Let's say it had, you know, tens of thousands of jelly beans, but you don't know exactly how many. Even if you had different individuals counting them, you're probably going to get different numbers from that. And that's counting one thing. Now imagine that there are dozens of things on each sheet of paper that you have to count. You're going to have three problems with that. That's been proven repeatedly through research. One, it's going to cost a lot of money. You're going to need a lot of human power to do it. Two, it's going to take a really long time. And that time that it takes to count those paper ballots by hand is probably going to be a time during which the loser of the election might try to incite violence and chaos. And then lastly, it's not going to be accurate, because humans are bad at repetitive tasks like that over a long period of time, particularly as complex it is, whereas machines are good at it. This does not mean you trust the machines. This just means the machines do the initial count, and then after audits, you double check it. And then if it's really, really close, Josh, as you know better than almost anyone, there are provisions for things like recounts to make sure that in those super close elections, you've had multiple checks to make sure you've gotten it right. If you have an election that's decided by one voter, God forbid a tie, I mean, that happens, and it's going to be counted multiple times. I guarantee you one of those times is going to be entirely by hand.
Yeah. And so the point here is that the default is count the paper ballots by machine. And if it's a really close election, we're going to have multiple counts of it. One of those will be, at least one will be by hand in a recount, as every state has laws with respect to recounting close elections, as well as laws about how to challenge an election if you think there's something that has gone on. So here's a question that we get a lot. Why should I vote? You know, especially for listeners who aren't in so-called battleground states that will help decide the presidential election. You know, you have your hand in all 50 states at the really local level in many ways. So why should people vote? Why even bother?
God, that's such a good question. I hope you're asking everybody that question when you talk to them about this. I'm a big believer in democracy. And that doesn't mean that I feel my vote only counts when I voted for the winner or when the election is really super close. My vote is a way of expressing my investment in governance and my neighbors and society. And that might go down from the president at the very top where, you know, we get the highest turnout, but down to your local school board races. You know, probably most of us listening to this, Josh, we're the kind of people who, if there's a special election for dog catcher on a random Tuesday, we're probably there and we'll figure out who to vote for. But those votes make a difference. Even when we lose, we're showing our investment in our society, our democratic society, governing itself well. And by expressing ourselves, even in margins where we lose, we let the winner of that election know we're here. And we have some disagreements on policy, so that person can take that into account. It is just so important not only to vote, but to vote all the way down the ballot, to do the research on these things, where you can express to people at the local level as well as the federal level that you're watching, you're interested in making sure that our society, our governance of our society works, and you're going to be there for the next election.
So you sound like an optimist, like me. You know, but your name has been kind of dragged through the mud in some ways with respect to some of these conspiracy theories. So how do we stay optimistic during a time when there's so much doom and gloom out there?
Yeah, I should say first, I mean, my name has been mentioned a lot of conspiracy theories. I take that as a compliment. I think that, you know, it's easy to attack the people who might be perceived as effective, and that's the way I choose to look at it. But I should also say the degree to which I have been slandered or threatened pales in comparison to what these public servants, from secretaries of state down to poll workers, have suffered over the past 1,200 days constantly. And I can tell you also, my organization runs the Election Official Legal Defense Network, EOLDN.org, and we get in requests from election officials who need advice or assistance from lawyers pro bono. And the number of requests we're seeing now is as high as we've ever seen. And we're still months out from the presidential election.
And these are, you know, threatened criminal prosecution of local officials, or harassment, or even physical violence, right? Those are the sorts of things these people are dealing with.
That's exactly right. I mean, people following them from work, people sending them threats, people putting their jobs in jeopardy. I mean, it's Josh, you know, because you've worked with these people too. These are public servants. They're actually people who do this. You don't go into, ask any election official how they got into it. And they will, I do this all the time. Every single time it's by accident. No one went to college thinking they were going to be an election official at a county level.
And it's certainly not for the money either.
Exactly. There's no fame or money at the end of that rainbow. And they got into it by accident and they found a calling. They believe in it. And there are conservative Republicans in that group, and there are liberal Democrats in that group, and everything in between. And they work really hard to give us all our voice. And the fact that they're being threatened, not because they did a bad job, but because they somehow managed a secure, transparent, and verified election that withstood all the scrutiny it did in 2020 in the middle of a global pandemic with the highest turnout ever, is one of the great successes in American history. We should be throwing them a parade, and instead they've been threatened. But back to your original question, I am an optimist, and that's largely why I'm an optimist, because I get to work with these people. People ask me what I'm worried about in the election, and what I'd prefer to say is what I'm not worried about. I am not worried about whether the election will actually be run well. I am absolutely confident that the 2024 election will be run very, very well, with almost all voters finding voting is incredibly easy and convenient, that they can choose to vote either early in person or by mail or on election day, as well over 2/3 of states allow. There's only 3 states that basically require you to vote on election day, and those are Mississippi, Alabama, and New Hampshire. Most other states, there's another option. So voting is convenient, it's easy, it matters, and those election officials will make sure your votes are counted properly.
Definitely a good reason for some optimism. Unfortunately, we are pushing up on our time. There's so much more that you and I could chat about. We didn't even get to some of the fun facts about you, like, you know, you were on Jeopardy and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. We didn't get a chance to talk about your book called The Big Truth, which debunks all of the lies of the 2020 election. So maybe we can have you back and we can continue our conversation. But you've given us a lot to think about. So thank you so much. David Becker is, again, the one of the people who's on the ground working with local election officials in all 50 states to help fix and improve our elections. David, thanks so much for being on Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much, Josh.
All right, Josh, what is our election law highlight for this segment?
So when states pass a budget, they must include money for election administration. That's a law that has to be passed. So how much does it cost to run an election? A 2018 study suggests that it costs about $8 a voter to hold an election, with the total election cost nationwide being over $2 billion. Though the authors of that study say that that was actually a low estimate. Another study suggested that $5.3 billion per election is more accurate. Now, the cost per voter has gone down a little, as several states have moved to increased vote by mail, which generally costs less than having thousands of in-person precincts. The problem is that states typically don't provide enough funding for elections, as we discussed with David Becker. Yet 27 states have enacted legislation to prohibit or regulate the use of private or philanthropic funding to help run elections. And that's all happened since 2021. Of course, as we discussed with David, the so-called Zuckerbucks were used in an entirely nonpartisan way, and the 2020 election would not have gone off as smoothly as it did without these funds. Put simply, the Zuckerbucks were vital to help election officials administer an election during a pandemic. Maybe, as David also said, instead of just banning private donations for election administration, states should actually fund their election infrastructure adequately.
All right. Give us a fun election fact to take home with us and wow our friends with.
Let's stay on the topic of Zuckerbucks. What sorts of things did election officials actually use the Zuckerbucks for? Well, one election official in a mid-sized city told me that with the sudden shift to mail-in ballots for the 2020 election because of the pandemic, where so many more voters cast a ballot via the mail, he had a big problem. He had nowhere to store all of the ballots that were coming in. He did have a secure warehouse, but there simply wasn't enough space there. So he came up with an innovative solution. He could stack pallets of return ballots before it was time to count them. But that caused another problem. Where does he stack them all? So he bought a forklift with some of the money he received from Zuckerbuck and Chan. Maybe not the most obvious use of the funds, but without the forklift, he would have had no real way to secure the thousands of ballots that were coming in. That would have caused severe chaos in the warehouse as they were trying to process all of these ballots. It's sometimes those kind of little things that you don't think about that you have to deal with when the plans for election administration shift almost overnight because of unforeseen circumstances like a pandemic.
And what's that one thing that we can do to support democracy?
I'm a big believer in grassroots education. So today, I encourage our listeners to call a friend and tell them what you learned about the security of voting machines. That's a topic that I hear a lot about. There's so much misinformation out there about how our elections actually operate. And spreading true information about the ways that voting machines are tested and secured can really help. Then ask them to tell their friends.
Coming up in a moment, Fayette County Clerk Susan Lamb.
It's simple for me. You know, if you don't vote, I don't believe you have the right to complain.
And Kenny Barger, Madison County Clerk.
Absentee has become kind of a dirty word when it comes to elections, it seems like. But there are people that cannot leave their home. And to rob them of the right to be able to exercise their constitutional rights is wrong.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky Election Law and Voting Research Professor Josh Douglas.
County clerks are at the front lines of our elections. They are literally the people who decide where the polling places are located, which voting machines to use, and how to ensure there are enough poll workers. Today, we are thrilled to welcome two Kentucky county clerks to explain how elections actually operate. Susan Lamb is the county clerk of Fayette County, which includes Lexington, the state's second largest city. Kenny Barger is the county clerk in Madison County, which encompasses Richmond. Susan and Kenny, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So let's just talk sort of the basics. What's the role of the county clerk when it comes to administering elections? Kenny, you've done this a little bit longer, so I'll start with you. Just give us a basic overview of running an election in Madison County.
Well, one of the misconceptions is the county clerk runs the elections, and it's actually a four-member board that the county clerk is chair of. There's a Democratic representative selected by the local party, Republican, and then the sheriff is on the board also. So we, in Madison County, our office, our employees do the day-to-day in and out, actual boots on the ground running the election, and the board oversees that.
And, of course, but you're kind of overseeing what the board is doing. You're kind of at the front lines, right? So, Susan, you know, you're new to this position, but you've run an election already or help facilitate with the county boards. So how do you see your role in terms of administering an election?
Right. And I do appreciate what Kenny was saying about the County Board of Election. But, you know, I see my role as best described as an educator to the public and the community about our process and being supportive. I'm very fortunate that I have a team of eight election deputies and that actually handle our elections. So but I always work alongside of them to be able to improve the experience of our voters and our election officers. So,
Kenny, you've been the clerk since 2011. I said, Susan, you took the job last year, right? What's been the most surprising aspect of the work? Susan, we'll start with you, given that you have done one so far. What was the most surprising thing?
I think that the absentee ballot process, while it was most surprising, it was most intriguing. And I think that the opportunity to make improvements for people that sometimes don't have any choice but to submit an absentee ballot. So
tell us a little bit more about that. What aspect of the absentee balloting process is intriguing or did you not expect to encounter?
The fact that that the state statute says that if an envelope is not sealed, that we have to reject it. We shall reject. And so, of course, you have to reject an absentee ballot. The fact that we actually took a step further and took all of our election envelopes and we put double-sided sticky tape on them. And so my first election was the primary of 23, and we had a number of rejections because the envelopes weren't sealed. So then over the course of the summer in 23, we put double-sided sticky tape on, and we only had maybe a handful of rejections in the general of 23.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing to think about something as little as, you know, putting the double-sided sticky tape can make such a big difference. I mean, it's a good reminder to voters who are voting absentee to seal your ballot.
It is. And the other thing to know, too, is that those envelopes are not printed within the county. They're printed on the state level. So the county does not have the authority with those envelopes. So I've been trying to talk with the State Board of Elections to see if we could come up with a different methodology for those envelopes. But as you can imagine, we have a ton of those already printed.
Yeah. And for those ballots that you had to reject, did you notify the voters?
There is not a notification process.
Yeah.
So that's another problem. I know in the state of California, they mail in their absentees. That's how they vote. And they know when you order a ballot. They know when you receive it, when you send it back. And the voter knows when their vote's been counted.
Yeah.
And so I like those I'd like that. There's a room for improvement, I believe. Mm-hmm. So
something for the state legislature to think about when, you know, considering various election rules. Kenny, what's the biggest myth or misconception that voters have about the voting process?
That we start the voting process a week before the election.
Hmm.
Right now, we're getting our equipment in order. We're making sure everything's the way it should be. Coming up in a couple of weeks, we'll start. We've already got our ballot laid out. We'll start working on really getting the equipment ready. And then in April, we actually certify the machines and set them up to be ready to go out for the May primary. It takes a whole lot of training of our staff to stay up to date on everything, and it takes a whole lot of training for the election officer.
Yeah, and so just our listeners know, we're recording this well before this is airing. We're recording in early 2024, and you all are already very busy in getting ready for the May primary and then the November general election.
Absolutely. I'd like to touch on something Susan said. COVID gave us the opportunity to totally change the way we vote in the state of Kentucky. We hadn't made improvements in over 200 years. Those rules were made when people rode horses, mainly men, geared for men, spring and fall.
I mean, to be fair, people still ride horses in Kentucky.
Yes, they do.
Maybe not to go vote.
Not to go vote. Yeah. But it's an agrarian calendar.
Right.
So it was extremely antiquated. So that process has been majorly improved over the last just couple of years or three. And now we need to start looking at our mail process. We are, if you compare our just the mechanics of it, the envelopes themselves, we are decades behind other states in just putting colors on certain spots. There's a nonprofit agency in Washington, D.C. That's all they do is work on government mail. So we have to get involved with those folks. And it's been on my list to work with State Board to make those changes. We have to, because you're right, mail has become, absentee has become kind of a dirty word when it comes to elections, it seems like. But there are people that cannot leave their home. And to rob them of the right to be able to exercise their constitutional rights is just wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and as you said, you know, looking to the best practices of other states, some states have a mechanism for voters to track their ballots right through the system, like they're tracking a package.
Intelligent mail barcodes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's simple. People do it now with their mail going to their home or going to their P.O. box. They know what's in the box before they ever arrive. They have a scanned image of it on their phone.
Yeah, and so certainly a best practice for voting as well that the state could implement. What does Election Day itself look like for you? What are you doing on, you know, the official? And of course, we have 3 days of early voting in Kentucky leading up to that Tuesday. But Susan, what are you actually doing on the voting days, and particularly on what we call Election Day?
Well, the first thing is you better get a good night's sleep the night before, because you're going to have a long day. Mm. The most exciting thing is you arrive in the office probably close to 5. Some of my staff gets in there at 4:30 because the poll workers are getting to their precincts and they're setting up. And so between 5 and 6, all the questions are coming in. My poll pad's not coming up. My printer's not connecting. I don't have a cord. I need this. I need that. So we have our County Board of Election comes and is at our office at 6 a.m. And we are working through all of the different things that are going on. And then at 6, when everything opens up, you're still continuing to provide that type of back up for everything. But in our office, I have 73 employees. And so all 73 employees are working on that day for the election behind the scenes. We close our doors for our other operations. And we have people that are assigned to answering the phones. They're assigned to opening up absentee ballots. They're going and they're taking care of issues out in the actual the field in the precincts. And the most exciting thing for me was to experience when at the end of the day, the precincts close at 6, and then probably around 6:30, quarter of seven. Then we start having, we had about 125 voting locations last year in the general election. So we had 125 vehicles with the Democrat and Republican inside the vehicles, party parity always. And they drove certain parts of the information from the election, from the precincts down to our office. And we have a whole system set up in our garage. And we allow six cars at a time. And we bring in, and inside those are the most important thing is the V drive from the Verity printers. And what's so cool is, and we take it in, we check off all the boxes, and then the Verity drive goes to our IT manager, who actually then goes and starts uploading the information from the elections. And it's the most exciting, exhilarating day I've ever experienced in my life.
Wow. And of course, just to kind of bust some myths that many voters have, you know, those machines, those voting machines you vote on, are not connected to the internet by state law. And so, you know, requires those drives that you are literally driving from different parts of the county into your office to do the count. Kenny, anything to add about what your election day looks like?
It's much the same. Most election day, the early morning, is exactly what I'm talking about, getting up and running. Once you get everything stood up and running, the calls slow down. Then we start getting calls. This voter's not showing up in the poll book. And we'll check them and decide whether or not they needed a, you know, what kind of ballot they need, that kind of thing. It's gotten a lot smoother for me over the years. We've got our pretty seasoned staff, and we've got a pretty solid group of precinct officers we can count on. One thing we did in Madison County was we added a precinct location coordinator, a PLC. And that person's not in charge, but that's our – if there's a problem, they call us or we call them. We can reach someone in that precinct and actually work through them rather than have to drive to every location.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So in Kentucky, like in many other places in America, we elect the people that run our elections in partisan races. You know, America is an anomaly. Around the world, we have nonpartisan election administrators in virtually every other advanced democracy. But here we do it on a partisan basis, including our county clerks in Kentucky. So, Susan, you're elected as a Democrat. Kenny, you're elected as a Republican. How does the partisan nature of the election to your office affect your work? And how do you maintain nonpartisanship in your role as election administrator? Kenny, we'll start with you and then we'll go to Susan.
Being a county clerk is not really a partisan job. It's a nuts and bolts process-oriented job, from licensing cars to recording deeds, and it rolls right into elections. And I want to say something about the group of clerks in Kentucky. The County Clerks Association, I was in the association for many years and didn't have any idea how the people I was working with were. We never even talk about it. It never comes up. Because if you're following statute, you don't have to be nonpartisan. You're following the letter of the law, nonpartisan is already built into that process. Mm-hmm. And if you are a very involved political person, the county clerk's job is probably not the one for you just because of this election. So you have to be nonpartisan or you're going to find yourself in hot water at some point.
Yeah. Susan, what do you think?
I agree. You know, the first thing that I started learning about the elections, about the party parity, I love that. I do think that's important because we all have valuable opinions, and I think that it's very important that we respect the opinions of others while maintaining our own opinions, but to be able to serve in the capacity for the betterment of the entire community. I think that it's a unique opportunity to be able to work with everybody, and I agree with what Kenny said. You know, it's so interesting when I started in this role, I started going to the Kentucky County Clerks Association meetings, and honest to goodness, I never knew, and I still don't know, didn't know it until I started in this process, what Kenny was registered. It doesn't matter to me because I want to work with everybody. I was on city council for 8 years in a nonpartisan role, and that really helped me to value and understand the importance of that. And to be able to serve everyone.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, again, I often think it's weird for our elections to be run by partisan, you know, people who have to get the job in a partisan way. But virtually every election administrator I speak with from all over the country and from Kentucky espouse that same sentiment that, you know, yes, they have to run an election and campaign, but once they put their election administrator hat on, the politics go away. And I think that's a refreshing aspect of the dedication of county clerks, of poll workers, of, you know, the people who are actually running our elections. So, of course, you can't do everything just through, you know, kind of whatever you want. You're bound by state law. You have to get approval from the state board of elections for various aspects. But how do you handle something like the legislature implementing a new law? So, you know, there's a new voter ID law in 2020. There's a new law a couple years later requiring 3 days of early voting, which we didn't have before. What's the process of just dealing with a new legislative mandate? Kenny?
Again, I'll go back to our association. In the last 4 years or so, Don Blevins, clerk previous to Susan, was instrumental in our legislation that came through Kentucky. Our County Clerks Association works closely now with members of the House and the Senate. We have Trey Grayson, former Secretary of State, as our lobbyist, and we are involved now with the process as it goes. I know that anybody that follows legislation, there are a lot of really good ideas legislators have until they actually find out how the job's done.
Hmm.
And the favorite thing I like to hear legislators say is, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I often say that just because you ran for an election doesn't mean you know how to run an election. And I think, unfortunately, these legislators who, you know, oh, I won, and so I know how things work, don't have the experience of actually administering an election.
Secretary Adams has been great to work with. We all have a common goal of trying to get closer to the voter, trying to make it more convenient to vote.
Yeah.
And it's been refreshing over the last 4 years to have the momentum we've built with the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Susan, what's the biggest concern you have going into the 2024 election?
You know, safety for our election officers. You know, in Fayette County, we've been very fortunate. We've not had any major incidents. You know, you have some people that come in and they're just rude, or they just might not, they just, they're having a bad day. But, you know, we're trying to train our election officers for this, but you just don't know how any one person is going to react to a situation on either side. So I think safety is one of the things that I am concerned with. And you try not to be alarming to your election officers, but you want to educate them. So it's a slippery slope. It's a fine line in there trying to figure out how much do you equip your election officers with just in case. And that's scary.
Yeah, it's sort of a sad commentary on how polarized we've become, that these people who are just dedicated to democracy for all are you know, facing threats. Kenny, do you have anything else that you're concerned about for 2024?
Yeah, our biggest concern, and it's a concern across the state of Kentucky, is enough people to work the polls.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have enough precinct officers. No county does, because it judged by size.
Good message here. You know, what's one thing that listeners can do to support democracy? Contact your county clerk and volunteer.
Go vote. GoVote.ky.gov.
Yeah.
They can sign up online. We've increased our pay twice in the last 5 years and still are having trouble recruiting. If we could buy equipment, we can find locations, even though as hard as it is to come by the money or find somewhere to vote. But if we don't have the people to staff that location, then, and you want to talk about election security, what if you don't have enough people to be able to watch what's actually going on in the polling location?
Yeah. All right. Final question for each of you. Why should people vote? What's the point? Especially, you know, if we think that Kentucky, well, kind of know who's likely to win the presidential election in Kentucky. So why bother?
It allows us to be a part of the solution and to cast your opinion for who you prefer in leadership roles. It's simple for me. You know, if you don't vote, I don't believe you have the right to complain. Be a part of the solution is big for me.
Yeah. I have a bumper sticker in my office that says, if you don't vote, don't whine. Anything to add, Kenny, on why people should vote?
Absolutely. The average drive-through time in a fast food restaurant in the United States of America right now is 6 minutes and 30 seconds. At non-peak times in Madison County on early voting and election day, it's 10 minutes to vote. So if you're willing to sit, and that's an average time in a drive-through line. If you're willing to sit for 6 minutes and 30 seconds at McDonald's, you should probably be prepared to give 10, 15 minutes to exercise your right as a as a United States citizen.
As being part of a community. Well, thank you both for joining us. Susan Lamb, the county clerk of Fayette County. Kenny Barger, the county clerk in Madison County. This has been so great just to learn a little bit about the inside baseball, the nuts and bolts of elections. So thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Josh, you've noted that Kentucky has one of the most reasonable voter ID laws in the country. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, we touched upon it a little bit when we spoke with Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams, but it's worth discussing again. In 2020, the state passed a compromise measure on voter ID, and I had the fortune of being part of the legislative discussion of it. Lots of IDs count, including student IDs, although the legislature in 2024 has been discussing taking that away, the student ID aspect. Under the law, it's okay if the ID is expired. If a voter shows up without a photo ID, but they can show a non-photo ID like a credit card or Social Security card, they can vote with a regular ballot just like everyone else after they fill out an affidavit under penalty of perjury attesting to their identity. That's different from a lot of other states, which require voters to take an additional step, like going to the county clerk's office after the election to have their ballot count, and you won't be surprised that very few voters actually take that additional step. Importantly, there's zero evidence of the kind of fraud that an ID law would prevent, in-person impersonation. One study actually looked at all elections over 12 years with over 1 billion ballots cast in those elections and found only 31 possible instances of voter fraud. And most of those were things like a father and son with the same name showing up and the poll workers checking off the wrong person. Strict voter ID laws do, however, disenfranchise some people, but at least the Kentucky law is pretty reasonable and is unlikely to disenfranchise voters given the fail-safe mechanisms that the compromise law includes.
Well, this is great to know. And let's get another one of those fun election facts.
So we just spoke with two Kentucky county clerks, and so I thought it'd be interesting to learn about the history of clerks. Clerks are one of the oldest known officials in local government, dating back to ancient Greece. The word clerk comes from the Latin word clericus, meaning a person who could read, write, and serve as recorder. Ancient Greece had a city secretary who read official documents publicly and who, at the beginning of meetings, proclaimed a curse on anyone who should seek to deceive the people. One of the earliest offices created by colonists in Massachusetts was the recorder, who managed elections of town officials and governmental appointments, in addition to tasks such as sweeping the meeting rooms, selling seats, and ringing the bell. The term clerk appeared in the middle of the 17th century, and around that same time, clerk responsibilities expanded to verifying voting rights based on property deeds and administering the oath of office to elected official. It's safe to say that clerks have served an incredibly important role in American democracy for centuries.
And speaking of democracy, what's one thing that we can do to support it?
So I mentioned that early voting is fairly new to Kentucky, and some other states have recently adopted early voting days. And yet in previous election cycles, not a ton of people have used it, maybe about 20%. So if you like early voting, if you like early voting days, make a plan to vote early in the upcoming election. Make it so popular that the legislature can't consider taking it away.
Next in the Democracy Optimist series, judges, elections, and money.
We have done this sort of research for over a decade at this point, and in a lot of our prior studies, we've made the point that money is able to impact judges and their decision-making in a few different ways.
Emory University Law Professor Joanna Shepherd.
Money is used to win elections, so it can affect which candidates actually win and who is on the bench in the first place. And then the second possible pathway through which money can affect the ultimate decision-making of judges is by judges who are kind of thinking about their next reelection. The fact that in 3, 2, 4, however many years, they're going to have to run again. They're going to have to raise campaign funds again. And so they may actually decide cases differently than they otherwise would because of their need to raise this campaign money in the future.
Shepherd has collaborated on a book titled Free to Judge: The Power of Campaign Money in Judicial Elections. Her co-author is Michael Kang, a law professor at Northwestern University.
I think the relationship between campaign money and judicial decision making, as Joanna said, it's a pretty robust relationship. We find that with all different kinds of contributors. We found that for different eras before and after Citizens United. So I don't think the basic predictive relationship between campaign contributions received and decisions that are favorable to the interests of the contributors, that I don't think that's new. It might be increasing a little bit, but I don't think that the basic pattern is different. I do think the role of money in judicial elections is increasing overall.
The money makes it much more difficult, certainly.
Joanna Shepherd.
Even if a state is running a nonpartisan ballot, which means that on the ballot, the candidates are listed without party labels next to their names. If you have a lot of money, they're typically running TV ads, social media ads, and they will make it very clear what the political affiliation of the candidates is, even if these states are trying to run nonpartisan ballots. And so I do think that the amount of money and the way that it's being spent, and as Michael said, the purpose for which it's being spent, really kind of, you know, politicizing the courts, is making it much more difficult for the candidates and the states overall to run nonpartisan elections.
And we'll hear why, because of the way money can influence the judiciary, it's all the more important not only that you vote, but that you know about the people behind those names on the ballot.
Not only should people vote, but it would be ideal if people were educated about the candidates while they were voting. Because right now, the way a lot of people, the only reason they've heard of a candidate is because big money has run big ads about particular candidates they especially like or especially don't like. That kind of sticks in someone's brain when they're going to vote, and that's who they vote for or against. But a lot of times the information that voters have, if they're not seeking it on their own, is determined by the big money in the first place. And so, you know, it's not only important for people to vote, but to be educated about the candidates that they're voting for to make sure they're not just being influenced unduly by the money interests.
Shepherd and Kang argue for appointed judges with term limits to remove the judiciary from the influences and temptations of campaign fundraising. But in our next episode, we also hear this from a justice of the Kentucky Supreme Court.
I do think the election of judges and justices is a good thing if we can adhere to the constitutional guardrails. And that's where the difficulty comes in.
State Supreme Court Justice Michelle Keller.
I believe that we need some more robust and immediate reaction to those candidates who do not comply with the Constitution and the judicial ethics opinions that have been outlined in reference to these campaigns.
And you'll hear why Justice Keller dissented from a ruling that green-lighted a severely gerrymandered map in the most recent redistricting cycle, helping to turn the legislature's majority into a supermajority. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer, I'm the series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.